Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Nancy Rayner, who's an artist working with acrylic and who is teaching some very interesting techniques with acrylic painting and digital media. And we're going to be speaking with Ken Mayers and Daniel Craig of Veterans for Peace about the film Arlington West. I'd like now to welcome Neil Volz. He's a former chief of staff to Representative Bob Ney of Ohio and lobbyist with Jack Abramoff, and he's a participant in the documentary Casino Jack and the United States of Money, written and directed by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney. It opens at the CCA in Santa Fe this Friday, May 28th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So this is an absolutely brilliant documentary that paints a picture of not only the most, I mean, at least to me, inconceivable corruption of Jack Abramoff, but also of the entire movement that he was part of, starting with the college Republicans of the 1980s who supported Ronald Reagan. You were a young Republican yourself. What were your ideals that led you to go to Washington and work with a Republican Congress member?
Well, I definitely felt when I left for Washington in January of 1995 that I was a part of something much bigger than myself, and that I had a strong-held beliefs in limited government and the role of a more vigilant and active society than what I thought was going on at the time. I was a young college student, very idealistic, and ready basically to go burn the town down, as it was pretty much the ethos at the time.
Were there any specific ideals that distinguished what you felt was really good about Republicanism?
Well, it was more the idea of freedom and one's ability to take personal responsibility in their own lives. And ironically, at the time, there had been 40 years of government or of Democrat rule of the government. And during that period, some of the same type of corruption that we would see later with myself and others had set in, ironically, at that time as well. So there was also this opposition to what was going on.
When you say, just out of curiosity, when you say 40 years, what do you mean? I mean, there was Nixon and Eisenhower and stuff like that.
The House of Representatives, the Congress, had been run by the Democrats for four decades.
Right. Well, while he was in college, and a lot of this is discussed in some detail in the documentary, Jack Abramoff was already involved in, you know, a kind of money laundering and over-budget spending, and he eventually became extremely powerful in Washington, and he was part of this movement that vastly increased the power of lobbyists, which basically boiled down to a kind of money buys votes system. And Jack Abramoff's, I don't know what you want to call it, kind of evil genius was that he found money where nobody else had found it before, like from Indian tribes and from these, as they discuss in the film, garment factory owners in Saipan who were wanting to avoid human rights investigation and so on. What did he promise these people from whom he was taking money? What did he promise, and what was he able to deliver?
Well, I think that one aspect, and please understand that I am very much, you know, I've done a lot of soul searching and am doing my best to try and, you know, get on the right path and stay on the right path. So I am a reformed former corrupt lobbyist, but I still have right-wing tendencies. So I would suggest that there is an area in which Jack found fertile ground where those kind of clients in which government decisions would have huge impacts in their lives, whether it was Indian casinos where one government decision could open a casino next door that could threaten their livelihoods, or the CNMI garment manufacturers, where one change in the rules and regulations governing their industry could have a dramatic impact. So Jack took this idea that, you know, it's probably best to try and find a few clients that are willing to pay an amazing amount of money rather than go for your traditional, you know, lobbying client that isn't going to pay that much money. And he was able to find money where no one else had been able to find money before. There's no doubt about that.
So when somebody paid them, what did they ask for in return?
Well, for instance, you know, one of the Indian tribes was trying to block the Department of Interior's from opening, allowing for another tribe to open a casino within their market space. So it was really, it is this collusion of business and government that Jack and our team tapped into, where it was on behalf of one business, we were rigging the rules of the government to benefit another or to hurt another. And so it was a very complicated tale, basically, of, you know, again, Jack finding money where it hadn't been found before.
So he found the money, and he was also able, way more often than not, to deliver on what, in other words, they got what they paid a very high price, but they got what they paid for, namely votes that went their way.
In a lot of instances, yeah, our lobbying efforts were successful, and in other instances, we weren't successful. But you are correct that, you know, Jack and Mike with their business together on the one hand brought in an amazing amount of money, and our lobbying practice also brought in a lot of money. So from that perspective, it was a successful business enterprise. Of course, it was based on fraud and a whole lot of other bad things that we should all be ashamed of.
As we see in the movie, Jack Abramoff's attitude toward his own clients was often incredibly condescending and contemptuous, and yet he got huge amounts of money from them, and then he would get them taxpayer money and funnel their money to Republican candidates. So that was another thing that, you know, okay, an Indian tribe would pay money to get their, say, to get their casino protected, and then some of that money would go from Jack Abramoff to Republican candidates. So they were basically participants in a kind of buying elections thing. I'm sitting here in my house, you know, watching the screener of this film and thinking, this is so horrifying that my brain is exploding. But, you know, when you're there, you're inside of this, you're part of it, you're part of the culture. What was it like being inside of that, where that's considered just normal and acceptable?
Well, it's a little overwhelming to have those moments like I did, where you are able to kind of reflect and see how far down the slippery slope I fell, for instance. Because I think you're exactly right. There is an ability by organized interests on all sides to have an enormous impact on how the government works. And for me, as I mentioned in the film, there came a time when I almost felt like our government was just on autopilot, that the organized big money interests on all sides, not necessarily a partisan issue, but the players, that this play was going to play out no matter how any individual decided to act. And therefore, I came to a very cynical conclusion on my part that I was going to then behave in a very selfish and greedy manner to kind of get mine, because those things that had driven me to come to Washington in the first place, this idea that an individual can make a difference, this idea that, you know, we're all in solidarity to try and make these changes, became overshadowed by my own desire for money and power and these kind of things.
We're talking to Neil Volz about the film Casino Jack and the United States of Money, which is opening at the CCA this weekend. One of the things, there's a lot of kind of contradictions that stand out when you're watching a documentary like this. One of them is the overt Republican ideology, which was so prevalent at that time, in which the word family values was being used a lot. And then what we see in the kind of Abramoff corrupt culture, which was, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but what it looks like is really kind of hyper-masculine, super macho, all men, all white men, kind of boys club.
I gotta say that jumped out at me the second time I watched the movie. The first time, probably a little bit more introspective, this being such a personal matter for me. And I've gotta say, you're exactly right. You talk about a bunch of white guys behaving badly. This is just a prime example of that. And there is a lot of kind of locker room banter, you know, drill sergeant behavior, football talk, whatever you want to call it. But it is very much kind of, you know, this Wolfpack mentality of competitiveness and, you know, one-upping each other. And that very much fueled the way our team worked.
There's also another really profound and fundamental hypocrisy that was at work there. Abramoff's ideology and the Republican ideology at that time, and Grover Norquist stated this in a very eloquent and I suppose to non-Republicans kind of scary manner, which was to basically eliminate government, except with the, you know, possibility of having a giant military that stays in place, but, you know, and eliminate most of government entirely. And yet what Abramoff was peddling was basically huge amounts of taxpayer money. So the payoff to his clients was, for example, government grants and handouts of various kinds. Was this lost on him, or did he just not care? I mean, did it just devolve to a kind of cynicism?
You know, I'm not 100% sure, or, you know, Neil in his glass house tries not to throw too many stones. I'm not sure where other folks are completely, but I know in my own mind there was this grand rationalization, because you hit the nail on the head. On the one hand, there's, you know, and I was happily taking part in it, this kind of chest thumping to be the most conservative, you know, ultra conservative. It's like a label to wear in town where, you know, it leads to kind of this ultimate laissez-faire attitude where you're treating the sacredness of government and elected officials and activities as if it was just purely business, when it's not. That doesn't mean that I don't support limited government, that I don't think that there's a lot of places in which we could even scale back today, but it was this rationalization of, you know, trimming down government in areas that didn't enrich myself. And so, yeah, it's part of what I felt was this just encroachment, you know, step by step by step, where, you know, in the moment it's kind of like, okay, I'm not going to support, you know, I'll support that budget because we want to lower the money, but as soon as the budget's done, then I'm going to try and get all the line item appropriations for my clients that I can. And you can't really do both and stay consistent at the same time.
It does bring up what I think is an important conversation for everybody to be having, which is, what is the difference between business and government, both in the way they do their activities and what their goals are. And I think this, along with many other films and books and so on in our society right now, kind of bring up that conversation, which is important for everybody to have over the dinner table or between each other or whatever.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about it, and that's one of the things on the big list of items that I'm really ashamed of, is that I lost sight of just, you know, how sacred our election process is, that there are uniquely governmental decisions that our elected representatives are responsible for handling, and that we can't say that that needs to be a profit center, that needs to run as a private business. Yes, there need to be lines, and I think that the lines are, you know, have grown too far to the point where I think the influence of lobbyists gains as the size of government grows. But I don't think that those are I think those are two different discussions, not the same discussion.
There's a moment in the film where Bob Ney, who was the congressman from Ohio that you worked for, stated that he would actually be in favor of public financing of elections. You were both working for Ney and then working for Abramoff, and having been on those two sides, do you have any sense of what would happen both to the lobbying world and to the elected official world if we were to have public finance of elections?
My personal opinion on this is I respect where the congressman has come on this issue, and I know that it's heartfelt, and I think that there's obviously intelligent people can disagree on solutions. For me, I think that would impose a certain number of barriers to people entering the energetic give and take public debate that I personally have a problem with it. But I do think that, like you said, as part of the discussion on where we go from here, simple solutions are tough to find, and therefore it seems that, you know, sometimes finding common ground is the best next step. My personal view is that you start with the question of what is an acceptable money to spend within politics. Is it okay to write a newsletter? Is it okay to, you know, gather your neighbors together? The lines are very tough to draw, but we should have lines, and they should be bipartisan lines, because when one side or the other gets the idea of writing these laws governing how speech is regulated in this country, inevitably, because I saw it happen firsthand, the people writing the rules end up writing them in favor of their coalition, and that's not very fair to the general public.
We're talking to Neil Volz about the documentary Casino Jack and the United States of Money. You said at a certain point in the film that you were the poster boy for the revolving door between government and lobbyists. Describe what you mean by the revolving door and how that works.
In Washington, there is a policy of basically people leaving the government to go into the private sector, and then leaving the private sector and going into government. When it's done appropriately, experience is broadened, and our country probably benefits. When it's done in the way that I did it, special interests benefit at the expense of the public, because I was able to use the influence that I had gained as a public servant to help my private clients, because I wasn't willing to wait 1 year before I started lobbying again. So, you know, I must say that was an issue where initially, I tried to adhere to the one-year ban, and then you take a step at a time, and the next thing you know, I just blew right by it.
And 1 year isn't even really that long.
Yeah, they've now expanded it to a two-year revolving door, but it is something. There's a lot of attention focused on campaign contributions and how much money is spent on television ads and things like that. One thing that I do try and bring up in any interview possible is that I would encourage your listeners and yourself to kind of analyze the impact of the not-so-seen benefits that also skew the system towards organized interest. And one of those is the jobs. That inevitably, somebody within the government is normally sitting across from the table negotiating some sort of bill with a person who very well may be their boss in a year or 2 years. And both sides know that, and it definitely skews some of these discussions. And I think that this is one where we, again, easy solutions aren't always right there for the picking, but this is one where vigilance is required for the public to know who's going to do what, and basically connecting the dots. If what I was going through had been on the public radar, I wouldn't have been able to do what we did.
Right. The first story of Abramoff's wrongdoings that broke in the Washington Post, I believe that was in the fall of 2004. And I have to say, just as an aside, it's such a great example of the essential role of the press in democracy and law enforcement. But describe what that time was like as you were actually working for Jack Abramoff.
Well, for me, it was a situation in which by that point, I knew that I had strayed off the straight and narrow, of course, but also all this reporting forced on to me that I realized that I was involved in something much bigger than myself, and not in a good way. And so reading these articles allowed me to connect the dots, where some of the internally within our team, or like any organization, there are certain shell games that get played where you only know, you know, a portion of what's going on. That isn't me in any way, shape, or form trying to suggest that I'm not responsible for my own stupid decisions. I am 100%. But reading those articles made it plainly clear to me how big this was. And it frightened me more, but it also kind of forced me into this several years of introspection and soul searching before I finally just decided, hey, I'm involved in something bigger than myself, and I need to do the right thing.
Well, I mean, you were also charged with being part of this, and you, I believe, made a plea bargain. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, I pled criminal conspiracy charges. So I've got those charges with me for the rest of my life.
You didn't serve any jail time, but you had to do public service and so on. I was watching it and thinking, I mean, again, for I guess what you would call just ordinary people watching a film like this and who haven't really ever had any desire for vast amounts of wealth and power, here you are watching this lifestyle that included fancy clothes and private jets and these restaurants and skyboxes at sports stadiums and beachfront estates and all that kind of thing. You know, you're inside of that, and I suppose it gives you a kind of high that's maybe like, I don't know, like a drug high or something, and then suddenly you're out of it. What, talk about that contrast for you.
For me, I mean, the contrast between my lifestyle as a lobbyist with Team Abramoff and my lifestyle right now is pretty great. On the surface, you know, issues of, you know, money and things like that, it couldn't be any more different. I make less in a week than what I made in an hour working for Jack. But frankly, looking back on it, I was also allowing myself to be corroded by all these desires for the power and the ambition and the money. And, you know, I worry about who I would be right now if I hadn't gotten caught. You know, I'm trying, and I remain very ashamed of what the role I played in this scandal, and know that it will be with me forever, and hoping that I can undo some of it bit by bit through, you know, whatever avenue possible, going to talk to students or going being on the radio or what have you.
What are you doing now?
I'm the executive director for a nonprofit called Falling Upstairs. I live in South Florida now. After I left Team Abramoff, I went to go work for a couple years as a program director. Started off as a volunteer, worked my way up to program director for a organization that housed and helped formerly homeless veterans, and then ultimately moved down to Florida. Got a job with another nonprofit, and then now doing my thing here with Falling Upstairs, where we're trying to create revenue streams for things like bus passes and telephones for the homeless.
It's so interesting because, again, as I was watching it, I was thinking, there's not really an awareness among any of the people that I'm seeing in the film who are the players in this great corrupt drama. There's not really an awareness of people who are really struggling. And now you've chosen to work with the people who are kind of at the bottom of the economic ladder.
Yeah, definitely. I must say it helps me in some respects to come full circle, but it's also not that simple. I definitely believe in public service. I believe that, you know, for me, I wake up every day today, much like I did when I was driving out from Ohio to Washington. On one shoulder is this urge to serve others, and on the other is this urge to serve myself. And just by trying to acknowledge that, you know, that's something that's a part of me, it allows me to try and make the right decision on a regular basis, and that is to, you know, serve somebody else first.
Yeah, and it also, I mean, it's such an important set of discussions that are brought up by this documentary, and one of them is the question of what's enough. You know, everybody, of course, has to serve themselves and have to serve them their families and have a roof over their head and have clothes and food and things like that. But that question that people don't always ask themselves, what's enough? That must be something that you have had to address pretty directly, I would think.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, and it's a huge issue, and I think it's an issue that most of us who are willing to, you know, honestly look ourselves in the eye and take a look in the mirror and say, you know, what is enough? What are our priorities? I have kind of a silly little process that, you know, I've implemented with myself that I use to try and keep myself on the right track. It's what I call the way-off theory, And I don't want to sound too self-helpy here, but it works for me. And for me, it just the title alone kind of says, it reminds me how way off I got from the person I wanted to be. And then it's also an acronym for, you know, what are you fighting for? And I think I yearned for kind of answers to these questions that you're bringing up. And over the last few years, I've realized that, for me at least, it's just very important to keep asking the questions. Because sometimes there aren't big answers to complex questions that are always going to present themselves. But if I keep asking myself those questions, I can at least know that I'm giving it what I can.
Neil Volz, do you have any sense of what Jack Abramoff is going to do when he gets out of prison in December?
You know what? I don't. I've heard, you know, different theories, and it's one of those things where I'm really not sure.
I can't help but wonder whether he's going through the same process that you are.
Jack is a man of a lot of depth, so I'm curious as to where his head is right now. I would not be surprised if he's, you know, wants to come out and leave a more positive legacy. But I also, you know, could see that maybe he's, you know, in another place. And so I'm just hoping for the best, because I think he will be in a situation in which, you know, mercy follows justice. And right now justice is being administered to him in prison.
Neil Volz is former chief of staff to Representative Bob Ney of Ohio, and he was a lobbyist with Jack Abramoff, and he is in the documentary Casino Jack and the United States of Money, which is written and directed by Alex Gibney. It opens at the CCA in Santa Fe this Friday, May 28th. You can find them at ccasantafe.org. Neil Volz, thanks so much for spending this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
You betcha. Thanks for having me. I hope people get out to see the movie. It's a good one.
I think so, too. I think it should be required watching for every voter in our democracy. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome now artist Nancy Rayner. She is a painter. She's the author of books about art and art technique. And she will be teaching a workshop at the Santa Fe Art Institute called Acrylic Painting with New Digital Imagery. And that is from Monday through Friday, June 7th to the 11th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, we had you on the air once before, and I found your work both beautiful and fascinating because you paint with acrylics. And, you know, I think a lot of people who are painters, they sort of love the lusciousness and richness of oil painting, but then when it comes to acrylic, they dry so fast and they're easy to use and stuff. But you actually are using the acrylic medium in the fullness of its possibilities.
Yes, well said. Well said. I think that often artists will use acrylic or any new medium and try to imitate a medium that they're used to, which
exactly.
makes sense. But I think acrylic can imitate oil and watercolor, but when it's used to... It's sort of a different animal, and when you really know that animal and use it to its best effect, you get totally different, unusual sheens, textures, all kinds of rich qualities that you can't even get with oil. So it's fun, and this workshop is going to be investigating that quite a bit.
How would you describe the specific properties of acrylic paint?
Well, it's sort of like Photoshop, a big, huge machine. It's really hard to define it. Like I said, it can imitate other mediums, but it also can make unusual looks all by itself. It's fast drying, but now there's a new slow drying acrylic.
Really? So that you can kind of mess with it for hours?
Yep, just like oil. So basically, with acrylic, every possible characteristic you can think of, you can customize and change. So if it's, you can make it stringier, you can make it dry quicker, faster, you can make it thicker, thinner, transparent, opaque, every quality you could think of, you can change.
Now, one of the things that you are doing is you're making these, what look like kind of acrylic peel-off layers
yeah.
that you can then work with in other ways. Describe some of the techniques that you're doing.
Sure. If you take any acrylic, and that could be acrylic with color, we'll call that paint color, or it could be a gel or a medium, which is the binder by itself without any colored pigment in it. any of these products, you can put on a removable surface, like a garbage bag. And when it's dry in a few hours, you can peel it up, and then we call it a skin. So it's basically a piece of acrylic without a substrate, without a backing. If you think about a cake in layers, you can think about the acrylic painting in layers. You can actually make each layer separate on a separate surface, and then you can decide, mix and match these layers together and glue them together and make a whole new painting.
Now, are they sufficiently translucent that when you have three layers, you can kind of see through them?
Good point. That's what I like to do, is each layer that goes on top of a previous one, I like to consider it more transparent and more translucent than the one before, so that if everything's opaque, you end up with a buildup, kind of a crusty buildup. But if each layer is transparent or translucent, then you get a very interesting look when you have, say, six or seven layers all working with each other in that final last layer. You could see all the way through them, sort of like water looking through a lake or a river.
There's a painting technique which is, I only know the German word, it's called Hinterglasmalerei. That means it's basically painting on glass. And so you have to start, because the surface that you see is the glass and then the painting is on the back of the glass, you have to do the part that they're going to see most first, like the highlights on the object, and then let that dry and paint on top of that. And it's also doing it in various layers. It sort of reminds me of what you're saying.
Very similar, very similar. And the acrylic is clear and glossy, so that if you think about every painting layer, three or four layers, let's say, in between these three or four layers, you have a clear glossy layer, maybe an eighth inch thick. You're actually increasing the refraction and that beautiful quality of pebbles and shells that when they're wet, they have that gorgeous color. It brings out the color. And that's what most people like about oil paint, is the refraction of the pigment. And acrylic can do the same thing if you add those layers of clear gloss in between.
You were showing me earlier these skins that you made, and they're literally on pieces of plastic, and you peel them off. There's also a digital element to this. You can actually do digital art, and what, do you print on these acrylic skins?
Well, this is the amazing part of the workshop, is the skins is only part of it. You can take skins and actually anything that we can put in a printer, even canvas, foil paper, fabric. The skins are just exciting because you can regulate the transparency and opaque quality of them. But any skin or fabric, you can run through a printer, and there's new grounds that enhance the inkjet quality on these surfaces. So that, let's say you take a piece of aluminum foil, you can coat it with this ground, then run it through an inkjet printer, and you can print old paintings that you have, drawings, found images, anything you could possibly think of, portraits that you took of yourself, and you can print them directly on the aluminum foil. Then you can glue that in and do it again with a clear, glossy skin, let's say, and paint on the back. And the great thing is that the inkjet is water-soluble, so once you print it, you can then go in there with water and a brush and mess around with it and make it more painterly.
Oh, my goodness.
And then when you're painting on top and underneath, you could sort of incorporate the printed imagery much easier, integrate it much easier with the paint.
So if you have, for example, photographs that you've either taken a long time ago and scanned in, or digital photographs, you can use those, then they print out, and then you mess with a brush, mm-hmm. and they become sort of paintings. Or you can take photographs of your paintings, and then it's like a meta layer of that painting.
It's mind-boggling what you can do with it. You can even take a painting that you've already made, let's say a large painting, take a digital image of it, put it in your computer. You can mess around with it on Photoshop or not. But if you print it out on a clear, glossy acrylic skin, then some areas are transparent. You can then place that skin on top of a completely different background. So you can take your one painting and change it 10, 15, well, infinite ways.
It's such a funny combination of high-tech and super low-tech kind of technique.
Yes, yes. A lot of photographers really like the digital imagery, because there's some photographers that want to transfer into painting, and they've painted on their photographs, but this is a whole different ball game, where the image and the paint can merge in whole different proportions and ways.
Back in the old days, when there were still readily available Polaroid cameras and film, people would take Polaroid cameras and then, before the image was ready, peel the thing off and transfer that onto watercolor paper. those days are gone. They were called dye transfer, which is a term that had two different meanings. But yeah, you can't make that film anymore,
and it's a shame. That was a really interesting effect that you can definitely replicate with this.
Yeah.
And a lot of artists like transfers, which usually are some kind of Xerox on a piece of paper. You flip the paper over, embed it into the acrylic, and then you have to work the paper out with water and, like, it all balls up and stuff. And this is so much easier, so quick. You can have an image printed on acrylic literally in an hour, ready to paint.
We're talking to artist Nancy Rayner. So when you do this, let's say you teach a workshop, are you expecting pretty much experienced artists who have a body of work that they're bringing to this process?
No, absolutely not. Any level can take this workshop. I like to teach multi-levels, actually. I love having advanced professionals with beginners because each different type of level brings up different questions, and I've seen beginners attack painting with a zest that advanced painters have to think about things sometimes and too much. But the good thing about this workshop is we're keeping the maximum at 8 people, and it's a whole week. I'm going to have 2 printers. Golden Paints is supplying an enormous amount of paint and products, already made skins. So we can just start right in with the whole process on the first day. And with only 8 people, there's a lot of private work I can do. So if somebody's never painted before, they'll have no problem.
So let's talk a little bit about your work. You do all sorts of different kinds of paintings. You do nature paintings. Have you always worked in acrylic? I mean, is that really your medium?
Well, I was trained as an oil painter and taught oil painting and life drawing for many years. And then about 14 years ago, transferred into acrylic, and it changed my work completely. It actually took a whole year the first thing I started to do was to take the acrylic and work like I was as an oil painter, and that took about a year. And then the light bulb went on, and I said, oh my gosh, this medium can be used in a whole different way. And that's when my work really changed.
It's like that with every medium. I mean, when film came into being, first they were filming theater productions. And so you'd have basically a film of a stage production, and they're like, oh, wait a minute, this film has expressive properties of its own. And, you know, and it's like that with everything. Now, you do these nature paintings that have a lot of water in them. Is there something about acrylic that lends itself to that kind of watery?
It's interesting. Yes, I do like using it to replicate watercolor and get these washy effects, and then contrast that with the more opaque ways of using the acrylic. To me, paintings using contrast create a whole different dialogue. So because acrylic has such a broad range of the way it can look, it gives me much more range in terms of using contrast. So using these washes and then using the opaque looks, but that didn't answer your question about why I use water. I don't know. People ask me that all the time. Maybe living in the desert, I miss the water.
Interesting. And you do also something that you call energy field paintings. What's that about?
I like working abstractly where the imagery is unrecognizable and where the viewer can make it into their own image. So I call them energy fields because they're like color fields, except they're really not about color anymore. They're about space and creating this experience of space and being in a place. So if I called them a color field, it would feel a little more flat to me.
Right. And it's also, it harks back to a whole tradition of color field painting.
Exactly. Yeah, you just answered why I I didn't realize that's why I do it. Yes, right. Break away from the history a little bit.
Yeah. Nancy Rayner is an artist, and she's going to be teaching this workshop at the Santa Fe Art Institute, limited to 8 people. Now, there's a price on it, but scholarships based on need are available, and they're certainly encouraging everybody who wants to go ahead and sign up for this course. As we said, all levels are welcome. You can call the Santa Fe Art Institute at 505-424-5050. And you can also check them out on the web at sfai.org, Santa Fe Art Institute. And you can also look at Nancy Rayner's work. And her website is nancyrayner.com. And Rayner is spelled R-E-Y-N-E-R. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome Ken Mayers and Daniel Craig. They are with Veterans for Peace here in Santa Fe, and they're here to talk about a film that is screening this coming Sunday, the 30th of May, at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at 7 in the evening. It's called Arlington West. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello.
Thank you.
What is Arlington West about? I have not yet seen it.
Arlington West is actually an event that happens every Sunday on about four different beaches in California, as well as some other locations. The local Veterans for Peace chapters set up crosses in the sand in Santa Monica, Santa Barbara, Huntington Beach, San Diego. Schedules vary, but at Santa Monica, which is the largest one, it's every Sunday. They set them up at 6 o'clock in the morning. They take them down at sunset. And in Santa Monica, it's right next to the Santa Monica Pier. So about 30,000 people every weekend see this, and they visit the site. The film consists of scenes of setting it up and mainly of interviews with people who come to the site. Lots of interviews with veterans, with the survivors of veterans. It's a very touching film and aesthetically beautifully done.
What are the crosses all about? Why are they setting them up?
They're setting them up as, in effect, a replication of the tombstones in Arlington, in the National Cemetery. For the first couple of thousand deaths, they had a cross for every death. In the more recent years, because they were running out of beach room, they started setting up one cross for every 10.
Are you talking about deaths of U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan?
U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's right. In addition to having the crosses, which are very carefully laid out, as those who come to film see the film will see, it's beautifully done. But they also have displays. They have columns that have names and pictures and basic biographical data, where the individual was killed, what unit he was in, where he was from, similar to the banners that we used to display here. And they allow people to create a name tag, in effect, which they can put on any of the crosses for their loved ones. And they also collect memorabilia that people leave, whether it's flowers, lockets, a variety of things. They maintain all these things in boxes. They have a catalog of them. So if you were to go out there and visit the site and look for someone in particular, they could tell you, oh, yes, here's the memorabilia of that individual. So it seemed to us that for Memorial Day weekend, this would be a most appropriate way of people to kind of break out of the car sales mentality of Memorial Day and really take the opportunity to observe, and for those who feel like honoring the vets, honor them. For those who feel like just mourning or grieving them, would give them an opportunity to do that. And we'll have a period of discussion after the film for those who want to stay and discuss it.
There seems to be a bit of a cultural conflict between the families of veterans who've died who are against war and those who are pro-war. How does this play out in what you've seen here, for example, in Santa Fe, in your activities as Veterans for Peace?
I think Santa Fe is a bit of an anomaly, is that we have a lot of support here in our endeavors with Veterans for Peace. Other places aren't so... I hate to use the word liberal because you can use it in so many different connotations, but people are more open-minded in certain ways. So we haven't done it in big numbers, but standing out on the corner on Fridays, and we get more support for our banners than we would harassment. And I think one of our goals in our chapter is to educate people about the cost of war, not just financial, but the human cost, the socioeconomic cost. And when we have one-on-one conversations, people, and they're open-minded enough to have a conversation instead of just sort of rant and rave at us, which has actually been rare, it's a dialogue, and we talk about, we're not fanatics, we're not nuts with this agenda, we're just trying to educate people about this is what's happening to us as individuals and as a society when we're not educated, we're not informed. I was, you know, talking about MacArthur's speech, and he says a well-informed citizenry. And that's what really our goal is. It's not to, we don't have an agenda in that respect. It's just to educate people, bottom line, because if we're going to have an informed citizenry, well, someone has to do it. And the system as it exists is not invested in informing people about these things because they need people to support, you know, the empire building or whatever words we want to use to describe what we're doing as a country all over the world. So we get a lot of support here. And I can't say that as opposed to places, other places don't get support. But I know we've been very welcome here. We're a big part of the peace community.
And you are a veteran of the first Gulf War.
Gulf War in 91.
And you can...
Vietnam.
Of Vietnam.
But I think you're right. The tendency is to be a sort of a chasm between the two major responses to either being a veteran returning or being the survivor of a veteran who didn't return or who returned severely damaged. For some, and it's not necessarily a permanent condition for one of these people. I mean, in Veterans for Peace, we observed that a lot of veterans come back working hard to justify mm-hmm. what they've done to themselves. And over time, frequently realize that as long as I try to do that, I'm trapped there.
Mm-hmm.
And start to look at what was really going on, why were we there, and so forth.
And as an individual asking, why did I do what I do? Like, I was told a story, I acted out based on the story I was told, and there's some incongruency there, and we start finding out that what I was told and what I did, there's this disconnect.
Well, so I've heard that, and I've not studied this very closely, but that quite a lot of soldiers in Iraq were reading Jeremy Scahill's book Blackwater, and that there was really a great deal of cynicism about why they were there, but they knew they had to be there, and they did what they were told to do.
You raise your right hand, you take your oath, and then your action follows. You do what you're told. You know, you obey the chain of command, and you're not in a position to question the chain of command without repercussions. I think what happens for X amount is we come home, and then we start learning. The party line and what we were actually doing are two different things.
And you'll see this whole range of feelings and opinions mm-hmm. in the film.
Right.
So regardless of whether you think it's the right thing for us to be in Iraq and Afghanistan or the wrong thing for us to be in Iraq and Afghanistan, you will have an opportunity to see how people who've been there react with this variety of experience and perspectives.
Some people look at this as, in what it is a memorial. Others, and you'll see it in the interviews, look at it as a political statement. And it can be construed as that, but it basically was a group of veterans who set up a memorial for those, right or wrong, left, right, it was a memorial for people who died doing what they did.
The film is called Arlington West. It is screening this weekend, Sunday the 30th of May at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Santa Fe. It's free. Daniel Craig and Ken Mayers are part of the Santa Fe chapter of Veterans for Peace. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Oh, and before we go, is there a website?
The website, vfp-santafe.org, and our information line is 505-715-6844.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents some artists who haven't been featured in a while. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.